For the week of September 14th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 249, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael, I gotta tell you, I say in Los Angeles, but what I should have said is in the hottest place on Earth.
Really?
Yes. It's like broiling here. Today, it's supposed to hit 106 degrees.
Well, that's not the actual temperature, but the heat factor, how it feels, right?
No, that is the actual temperature.
In L.A.?
In L.A. Yesterday, it was 104 degrees.
You should leave.
And the worst part is I have to turn the air conditioning off to do the show.
Well, since you're going to be sweltering, let's get right to it. What are people going to hear about on today's show?
They're going to hear about how hot it is in Los Angeles, but they will also be hearing about the Toronto and Telluride Film Festivals, because it's that time of year again where we head up to the annual film festivals in Telluride and Toronto with Anne Thompson, editor-at-large over at IndieWire, where her blog Thompson on Hollywood can be found. Anne will fill us in on all the movies that had people talking and which ones we might be hearing a lot more about at Oscar time, but we're also going to be talking about, you know, do film festivals matter more now or less? Media streaming services are all the rage these days, as we've told you before. That may be why the heads of CBS and Time Warner are discussing over-the-top plays, and the music subscription service Deezer finally made its way to the United States. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Not yet, because my Weather Channel app says the high in L.A. is 98.
I told right now it's probably 98.
It says the high of the day will be 98. It says right now it's 97. You're a wimp.
Oh, my goodness.
It's really, really hot. Okay. The number one movie around the world, and we are looking at worldwide box office. This comes from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull information from The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, Variety, you name it. The number one movie around the world, Scarlett Johansson in Lucy. Another $26 million. It's at $354 million worldwide. It's the biggest hit of Luc Besson's career as a director. And yes, Berlin, that does include adjusting for inflation, because it looks like Lucy has just about matched the returns of The Fifth Element, which was Luc Besson's previous big hit as a director. He's had an even bigger hit with the Taken series, which he's involved with, the Liam Neeson series. But Lucy matching his best figures ever, and of course, it's still going strong. It grossed $26 million this weekend. It's at $355 million worldwide.
And of course, he is a producer on the Taken series.
And he wrote the scripts too, as well, some of them.
I was going to say that, along with do these figures adjust for inflation? But since you already told me that they adjusted for inflation, I won't ask that.
That's right. And number two around the world is No Good Deed. This is a damsel in distress film that opened in North America. It stars Idris Elba of The Wire and Taraji P. Henson. Am I saying her name right? I hope so.
I hope you said Idris Elba or Idris Elba correctly.
Oh, Idris Elba. Okay, thank you. Well, that opened to $25 million in North America. As so often happens, they wildly underestimated how strongly black fans would come out for this film. It's a film that appeals to all people, of course. It's $25 million, but it's a very strong base in the black community. Idris Elba and Taraji are both big stars in that community and for anybody who likes good acting. I mean, Idris is a great actor, but this movie opened very strongly and blew past the expectations of the box office predictors. They were looking at like $8 million for the weekend. It grossed $8 million on Friday. So this was a big success story for the weekend. Modestly budgeted. I think it cost about $13 million, and it practically doubled that on its opening weekend.
Yes. This movie will be successful. I would say we'll probably get a sequel.
No Good Deed 2, No Good Deed Goes Unpunished. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the movie ends.
I haven't. Yeah, I was just going to say, I would say if this movie is about a damsel in distress, maybe they can team up with Luc Besson and have Lucy and No Good Deed, you know, she's not a damsel in distress, so maybe she can help out in the next movie.
Anyway, at number three around the world is Dolphin. You sound like a Hollywood executive. Anyway, number three around the world is Dolphin Tale 2. The story of a lovable dolphin that gets rescued and beloved by humans. It stars Harry Connick Jr. and Morgan Freeman. And who else is in this movie? There's a dolphin.
Ashley Judd in this movie?
Oh, Ashley Judd is in the film too. It grossed $18 million. It's the sequel to Dolphin Tale, which was a huge success in North America and made a ton of money on DVD and Blu-ray. And so they made a sequel. It cost more, but by God, it's still going to be a profitable film. I think Dolphin Tale 2 cost about $36 million because everybody made money on the last one. So it's about half its budget so far, but it will probably get to a good pace worldwide. So I'm sure this will be a successful film.
Now, I wondered what this movie could be about, because the first movie, Dolphin Tale, the word tale there is kind of a play on words, because it's a dolphin story, a dolphin tale, but it's also about the dolphin's tail, because his tail gets partially amputated, and they have to put a prosthetic on the tail to make the dolphin swim. But what happens to the dolphin now that they have a sequel?
Well, they saved the life of the dolphin Winter, and in the sequel, her surrogate mother, another dolphin, dies, and so they got to find Winter a new companion so she won't be lonely.
Ah, okay.
This isn't SeaWorld. They're nice people.
Ooh, so what? Put a pin in that one, because we will be talking about SeaWorld a little later on.
And number four around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy, another $17 million. It blows past the $600 million mark. At number five is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That made $15 million, and that's at $320 million worldwide. At number six, the Storm's Out of Control, Mother Nature's Really Angry movie. It's Into the Storm, another $15 million. They're still looking to get to profitability, but they should get there. It's at $133 million worldwide.
However, do you know what I call that movie?
No, I don't.
Twister 2.
Okay. At number seven is The Expendables 3. That's at $12 million. That's only at $180 million. It needs to get to $270 million in order to be considered, a clear-cut profitable film. But it's only in 29 territories, so we'll have to see where it ends up. Because look at Sex Tape. This is the film starring Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. She has a great record in the last 5 or 10 years. Cameron Diaz is worth every penny you pay her. This movie has now passed $100 million worldwide. It costs $40 million to make, but it's going to get there. It's going to get to $120 million. It's going to triple its budget worldwide, and that's exactly where the money came from. In North America, it made $38 million, and it's doubling that overseas and still going strong. At number nine is Divergent. That's a film we haven't heard from in a while. Did this open in China or something?
I have no idea. I don't know why all of a sudden. I think it actually did open in China, and that's why we're hearing about it.
Yeah. This is where we talk about worldwide box office and how little track we have of where movies have played, where they haven't played. We're really dependent on what the distributors tell us and what gets reported, because we just have no idea how long it's going to take for these movies to play out. Some of them get released worldwide very quickly. Others take months or even a year or more before all is said and done. Divergent is one example.
And this actually, I will confirm that it was Divergent did open in China this past weekend.
Okay. Well, Divergent was not doing great in North America. It grossed $135 million, and it was a pretty expensive movie. It was the first of a franchise, and they boldly said, no, we're releasing all the sequels, and in fact, the third book, we're going to turn into two films, because why not squeeze out more money? And I was a little iffy on that, because it seemed like they were jumping the gun a bit, but it cost $85 million to make, and it's now grossed $286 million worldwide. Well, that's more than triple the budget. And as far as they're concerned, these books were not well known overseas, just like The Hunger Games and others. And so they've introduced this idea to the world, and they're hoping that they'll be able to build on the franchise. Now that they've introduced the storyline to the rest of the world, they think it will do better in its second and third go around, just as, Twilight did and some other movies have done. I should have said Twilight, not The Hunger Games. I think The Hunger Games was very successful around the world as a franchise book series.
Yes.
Yes, that's what I believe. So Divergent, now well into profitability. It's long after everybody in North America has stopped talking about it, but it's still making money. Yeah, sure, it was in China, but it's already tripled its budget worldwide, and it's going to be doing just fine. And number 10 is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. That's at $670 million worldwide. Let's go all the way down to The Maze Runner. The Maze Runner has already opened up in a few markets overseas, as has The Box Trolls, which is an animated film that's about to open up here in North America. The Maze Runner opened in like 5 territories and did great everywhere it opened. It's number one in every country where it played, and it made $8.3 million. So it's a good sign that people are eager to see this film. The Box Trolls, on the other hand, made about $5.7 million. It opened in more territories. It made less money, but I have no idea how it did in each individual market, so I shouldn't comment on whether that's a good sign or a bad sign. But I will say that The Box Trolls got pretty bad reviews from the trade papers. They are not high on this movie. Not high on this movie at all.
No, and it's from the makers of Coraline and Paranorman, but
Both of which are very good movies.
Yes, they're great movies, and unfortunately, this one is not getting good reviews, at least from Variety and The Hollywood Reporter.
That's right. So,
and the Wrap and pretty much every other trade paper.
And one final film I want to talk about is Finding Fanny.
I don't know if we can. This is a family show, Michael.
And it's a family film. It's a film in India, from India. It was filmed in Hinglish, which is what one of the producers said, which means in Hindi and English. I'm not sure if it's a movie that combines both languages or whether it was filmed at the same time in Hindi and English.
So it's kind of like Spanglish, Hinglish?
Well, that's what the producer said, but I think he just means that they filmed two versions of the film. You know, they do a scene in English and then they do a scene in Hindi. That's my understanding. I'm not sure what the truth is, but it's a road trip movie. It's about a group of friends trying to track down the love of life of one of them, the true love of one of their characters, one of their pals. It's an offbeat comedy drama, not your typical three-hour musical that you might find in films from Bollywood. But what struck me about this movie, which cost about $4 million in India when it opened up, is its path to release. Their release plans got mucked up a bit. First, the movie was rejected because of a racy line.
That's right.
Female women says, "I'm a virgin." They didn't like that. They're like, "Oh, that's not, no, that's too much, too racy, too much. We can't handle it." This, of course, is a country where people don't kiss on screen.
That's right. The rejection of this movie caused quite a stir in the film community over in India.
Did it?
Yes. Well, I mean, it began to, because, as you're about to point out, I believe, that line was used in the trailer.
Yeah. The filmmaker said, "Well, we can't put it in the movie, but you let us put it in the trailer." That was approved, and it was shown all over the country. And they were like, "Oh, okay, never mind."
Yeah, well, and then there were some charges of like, well, gee, why is it that some films get past the censor board and others don't?
And that's when the head of the censor board was arrested on bribery charges.
Bingo, yes.
And that also delayed the release of the movie because there was nobody there to give it a certificate. They also had some issue with animal safety. The animal safety board didn't like a scene with a hen. I don't know what happened. I assume the hen is fine, though I don't know. But eventually all was cleared up and Finding Fanny was released, and we'll have to see if it ever makes it here to North America. Well, that winds up box office, and that, you know, that's the movies that are playing in theaters right now. But when you want to know what movies you should look forward to, one of the early bellwethers are film festivals and the coverage that you read from Ann Thompson, Thompson on Hollywood, and other sources. So let's talk about film festivals, Sperling.
Yes. Ann Thompson, of course, as we mentioned at the top of the show, is the editor at large at IndieWire and, of course, the editor of Thompson on Hollywood. And spent the last 2 weeks in the dark. And I don't mean that in a bad way. She was at the Telluride and Toronto film festivals, seeing all of the movies we will be discussing probably from now until whenever the Oscars are held this year. Anne, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Although there's a lot of films that didn't show at the fall festivals. We've learned a lot, but there's plenty more to find out.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean that the New York Film Festival is just going to start next, you know, in a week or so. And we're going to then find out Gone Girl, Inherent Vice. And then there's movies like I'm Broken from Angelina Jolie, Selma from Ava DuVernay, women filmmakers. Yay. And also things like the Tim Burton film Big Eyes or J.C. Chandor's The Most Violent Year. These are things that are still hovering, and Clint Eastwood's movie that hasn't been seen yet, American Sniper, that was a late entry in the year.
So in years past, did you feel like all the big Oscar hopefuls did play at film festivals and that this is a little unusual?
I would say this is a relatively paltry list so far.
And by paltry list, you don't mean the titles you just mentioned. You mean the ones that
have been shown
at Telluride in Toronto and even Venice. So there's this
there's like three.
Yeah, this troika of festivals every fall, starting with Venice and then Telluride over Labor Day. And then that kind of just plows us right into Toronto always the same week. And this year there was a little bit of a back and forth between Toronto and Telluride. Probably through the press. I don't know that they talked to one another, but
you know what's interesting is that the press was more sympathetic to Telluride and more sympathetic to the process of building buzz between the two festivals, which has always been an organic thing. And Telluride always ran under the radar, tried to avoid getting into the world premiere thing, announced their stuff at the last possible minute. And Toronto this time after the experience of having its thunder really stolen on Gravity and 12 Years a Slave, really threw down the gauntlet in public. My personal take is that they should have done it in private. They should have just done it behind the scenes and arm wrestled with the different distributors and told them what the deal was. But at any rate, it's interesting, inside the industry, there's more sympathy for Toronto. Inside the media, there's more sympathy for Telluride. Because it feels like the filmmakers should be the most important thing. The filmmakers and the process of building that buzz.
Well, here's my take on that. One, I think maybe Pierce Handling, the CEO of the Toronto Film Festival, and or Cameron Bailey did try and do it privately with the industry.
And by privately, we're saying that Toronto told people, look, you can't take your films to Telluride first. If you want to be in the first 4 or 5 days of Toronto, we better be a world premiere. And after that, you can be in the second week of Toronto. But we're just trying to make sure that we still have our buzz building big movies that you can't find anywhere else. And that's what we're going to showcase in the first 4 days.
Right.
But the distributors believe that Telluride and Venice and New York are more Oscar friendly than Toronto. And so they stuck to their guns and did premiere Wild and did premiere Birdman and did premiere Imitation Game ahead of Toronto. And so those films all showed like on, I mean, Birdman didn't go to Toronto at all. That's waiting for the closing night of New York. But Imitation Game and Wild, you know, and you know, we're on Monday night in Toronto.
Well, and we should say Birdman stars Michael Keaton and is directed by Inuyasu. That's his next film, the director of Babel. And I also think that the reason Telluride, or at least the press, is more favorable to Telluride is because we love going up there. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's in the middle of Colorado, or I should say in the middle of the Rockies. It's really hard to get to. It's a 2-hour drive at least from the airport to Telluride. And it's very lovely. It's very small. It's very quaint. It's a lovely festival to go to.
Very well curated. You can really count on all the movies all being, almost all being of a very, very high quality.
And so why is the industry more favorable to Toronto?
Because they understand this kind of competitive thing, the bragging rights, the fact that you want to be able to claim the first showing. They actually get that, and so there is no right or wrong here. But if you look at who really is being served, Toronto ended up being, I think they came out behind. I think they didn't show the big films on the first weekend that really were the big films. And they ended up with things like The Judge, which I skipped. One of the things that happens in Toronto is that you hear what everybody else thinks. And then you go, okay, I don't have to see that. And that happens on a massive scale. So that you're trying so hard to see the films that everybody likes, you know, the Pawn Sacrifice builds momentum and you have to see that, or a film I missed but wish I had seen, something like Love and Mercy, you know, ends up being something that ends up, or the Chris Rock movie Top Five. Fabulous movie, incredibly fun movie. You know, so over the course of the festival, you have to. It's all about building word of mouth, and so what comes out at the end is a list of films that everybody has to see. And if Toronto had allowed the normal process to occur, a lot of those films would have had the buzz built in and could have generated enormous attention on that first weekend.
Now, let me ask you this, because I said to Michael, I think it was last week or the week before, that really Telluride should be looked at as a big press junket, because it's, you know, the festival is filled with press, it's very small, and it kind of preps people going to Toronto who didn't
That's
go
right.
to Telluride, hey, here's what's good. And most of the films in Telluride are good, because if your film is not good, you're probably not going to want to show it at Telluride.
That's right, because you'll get killed. Poor Sophie Bart. I felt so bad for her with Madame Bovary. You know, they wanted that world premiere. They wanted the movie that no one had seen yet, and it got killed, you know, and it was for sale.
And
that's the kind of movie that should be in Toronto.
Well, so overall, how are you feeling about film festivals? We love them, of course. You get to go for a week or 5 days or 10 days, and you get to see a lot of movies, and you end up usually seeing 2 or 3 of the best movies of the year, you know, if you're having a good festival. But how important do you think they are in the whole ecosystem of Hollywood right now? Do you think they're more important, less important? Where do you think their importance is right now?
Hugely important. Hugely important. More than ever. Sundance, very, very important. huge market for emerging talent, emerging films, picking up distributors, the whole nine yards. Can still enormously important. Build the drumbeat for a number of films that ended up showing at Telluride and Toronto, Foxcatcher, The Homesman, where Hilary Swank is looking good because the best actor race is so paltry, Leviathan, which will probably be the Russian submission, one of about six movies that are being released by Sony Pictures Classics.
Leviathan, the film that mocks Putin, you think is going to be Russia's official choice for the Oscar? Not a chance in hell.
I actually did some reporting, God forbid. I checked into it, and it turns out that even in Russia, the party line is that you want to fight against corruption. We'll see. We'll see if that turns out to be the case. They want to win. It's always this question of which country does, you know, puts its best foot forward in its own self-interest if they really want to win. And Leviathan would be their strongest contender. He's I don't know how to pronounce the name. I'm going to say Zvagintsev, who I met in Telluride. That's the other great thing. You get to sit down at the Sony Pictures Classics dinner with some of these people. But he's in the running. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
And it's a great movie. It really is. But
I know what you're saying, but apparently everybody in Russia is supposed to be fighting against corruption, too. It's supposed to be a bad thing even there.
Okay. Yeah, well, that film is by Andrei Zvyagintsev, and his other movie, I want to say, was
The Return.
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, he's a great filmmaker, so it would be well deserved.
And then there's Merchants of Doubt, which is Rob Kenner's movie, a sort of follow-up in a way to Inconvenient Truth, you know, another participant film, another Sony Pictures Classics film. It's basically saying, why does everybody dismiss all of these, you know, not smoking's bad for you? It's about the corporate fight against what they don't want people to believe, like global warming. And it's really, really revealing of what goes on. And I would say Mr. Turner, of course, was in Cannes, and then Wild Tale is my favorite, the one from Argentina, which will be the likely submission from there. It was in Cannes. And then the brand new movie that emerged in Toronto, finally, The Imitation Game, front runner for the Oscar, Theory of Everything, that was in Toronto, another front runner, the Battle of the Brit genius biopics.
The one is the gay Brit codebreaker, Alan Turing, and the other is, of course, Stephen Hawking.
Who's a little better known, but part of the advantage of The Imitation Game is that you're watching history that you didn't know, and it's mind-blowing that this one man, this genius, managed to help us win World War II in a way that I did not realize.
It helped us win World War II and then got hounded to death.
Right, literally.
Well, I think the genius, if you like, of this movie is it combines so many different story threads into one story, so that you've got the history, you've got the code breaking, you've got the creation of the computer, you've got the misunderstood genius, the woman who's being Keira Knightley who's being discriminated against, and the sad story of a lonely gay man who is being discriminated against. It's a very moving and powerful and incredible performance by Benedict Cumberbatch,
who plays Alan Turing in The Imitation Game, which took home the People's Choice Award at Toronto this year,
which is often the bellwether for Best Picture, or at least the Oscar race itself.
Right.
That's right. I mean, previous winners were 12 Years a Slave, The King's Speech, Slumdog Millionaire, American Beauty. Well, you just mentioned a lot of movies, and that begs the question of how you covered them all. You seem to have a team of about 100 people at Toronto this year. Who were all those people contributing to your blog, and how did they get there? Who paid for it? What was going on?
IndieWire is one thing, and Thompson on Hollywood is another. I helped to get some people accredited through Thompson on Hollywood, like David Anson and John Anderson and Joe Layden, who's yet to file any stories. Joe, you owe me. and then you have Meredith Brody, who always covers festivals for me and has a place to stay up there and gets there on her own. Everybody got there on their own except me. I was helped by IndieWire. Matt Mueller is always up there. He covers for his own outlets out of England. So it seems like a lot, but it's not that many.
But that's the crazy new world, isn't it? I mean, people sort of are freelancers and they pay their own way to get to a festival so they can write some stories and get access to movies and material so that they can do work for the rest of the year.
You got it. It's a very powerful incentive to get up there and see as many movies as you can.
Well, do you think there were more
journalists? I have stacked up a queue of stories that is a mile long.
Well, and I find that there are more and more journalists going to this. It seems like film festivals are becoming more important, if only because, and Michael and I had a conversation right before we started recording, there are so many websites and blogs and media outlets now online that need content. They need to generate content to generate traffic. And so they all send either a stringer or a freelancer or somebody who's already at the festival, and they try and get stories. Whereas before, they would have overlooked Telluride or maybe written one 400-word piece on Toronto. They're now up there covering it day in, day out.
Well, there's also more Oscar noise. And there's also, because everybody's looking for search optimization, as SEO, as we call it in the trade, traffic, in other words. It's like everything is filtered through the Oscars. And I shouldn't complain about this because I've been doing this too. And it's part of, you know, all the trades have to sort of function in this world. But it is disturbing too. There are a lot of films. I mean, Nightcrawler is a movie I loved that I saw in Toronto. You know, people were jumping up and down to get interviews with Jake Gyllenhaal, and it was one of the breakouts. But, you know, maybe it's an Oscar contender and maybe it isn't. You know, there were a lot of good movies shown there that may not be, you know, The Drop, which just opened, you know, that's not going to be in the Oscar race. You know, The 50-Year Argument from Martin Scorsese, wonderful movie that's going to show in New York and show on HBO, not eligible for the Oscars. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't cover it or talk about it, you know?
Well, and you said that film festivals are more important than ever, specifically Sundance and Cannes and Venice, and you were talking about Telluride in Toronto here. But I guess I look at, like, The Skeleton Twins, which was released with Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader this past weekend, and that was a big hit at Sundance, and yet didn't really do well. I find that some of these
big... It did all right.
Okay. I mean, do you find that some of these big festival hits eventually make their way into theaters and they do modestly well, but not as well as one might expect if they were only listening to the festival circuit?
There's always a lot of films that get attention at Sundance that end up opening and not doing as well as you would expect. But Skeleton Twins isn't one of them. I mean, it did very well, actually.
It opened on 15 screens and made $25,000 per screen. So it had a solid opening weekend.
Yeah.
That's certainly
for
those two actors are not commercial draws. So we'll have to see where it ends up. But that's certainly a respectable opening.
Exactly.
This is what happens when you ask a question without having done the research first.
Well, and of course, every movie is its own story, just as every film festival is its own story. And I love New York Film Festival because I haven't been able to afford to go to Cannes and Toronto and these other places. And New York, for me, is like the curated film festival. They let all the other festivals scour and find the good movies, and then they pick the best of the best and show them in New York without too much worry about, you know, what's been shown elsewhere before. Except they just added a movie about 10 minutes ago. This is a documentary about Edward Snowden. It's going to be
Laura Poitras.
That's right. Oscar nominee Laura Poitras and MacArthur Grant winner. And this documentary about Edward Snowden, who she's been involved with for several years now. She's one of the two people to actually get the data dump of all that info he had on the NSA. She's got a new documentary film about him playing at the New York Film Festival, and that's called Citizen 4. And it's just been added to their official lineup like minutes ago. So there's some buzz for you. They'll be excited about that.
Absolutely.
Now, are you going to the New York Film Festival?
Well, I'm a little bit
burnt out,
tired of traveling because I went away for 2 weeks.
You don't need to, right? There's only four.
I need to see Gone Girl and Inherent Vice, so I think I am going to go for opening night. I haven't booked my ticket, but I better get my acting gear. I better get that going if I'm going to go. So yeah, I'll be going.
Well,
I do this every year. It's the same sort of dragging my feet and then recognizing that I have to be there.
What about Abu Dhabi?
No.
You can't, they're closing night film, and now you're saying no. Is that because, for me, I wouldn't want to go to Abu Dhabi because I feel like it's going to Sun City in apartheid South Africa, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it isn't that. It's just traveling. I mean, I've in the past, I've gone to London, and it was a great festival, and it was fun to be in London, but you do deal with flying across the pond. And I've gone twice this year. I went to Cannes and to Karlovy Vary in Czech Republic in the summer, and it was a great thing. But I'm not flying across the pond again. You know, I'm done. I got a lot to do. It's Oscar season. I'm busy.
I know most of Hollywood has no problem with Abu Dhabi. There are people who film there, people who go there for festivals, for music and film and all that. But, I mean, this is a country with a horrific human rights record. They've got slave labor building their country. Women are raped there. And if you report it to the police, you are thrown into jail for being a whore because you've had sex outside of marriage. This is the country we're talking about where foreign travelers, you know, Jews and people from Israel are not welcome. Women are not particularly welcome. Gays will be thrown into jail. And yet Disney is opening their film, what's it called?
Big Hero 6.
Their next big animated film is the closing night film at the Abu Dhabi Film Festival. I guess that's not a problem for Hollywood or for most people. They don't see that country as problematic.
I think we all have to make these human rights decisions. There are a lot of us who have problems going to Russia right now for other reasons as well. And you just have to call each one as you see it.
Well, now, speaking of calling things as you see it, you used to call the Oscar race as you saw it on a podcast called Oscar Talk, which is kind of been retired. And you're doing Screen Talk now with Eric Cohn.
Yeah, Chris Tabley and I from incontention.com did the Oscar Talk for 5 years, and you know, we did it weekly, and then the last year, because he was sort of pulling back, we did it monthly, and finally we ended it. And he, you know, to his credit, Chris was the one who did the production and organized it and edited it and everything, and I was, you know, it was easy for me to just sort of show up and do the phone call, you know.
I know how you feel.
Just like this, you know, same thing. But I miss it. I love doing it, and I love him. But I managed to, you know, Eric Cohn of IndieWire, the film critic of IndieWire, was willing to take on that role. And I think Screen Talk is covering more ground in a way, because we're not limiting ourselves to the Oscars, although that's certainly part of the conversation. Every Friday morning, it is coming out, Screen Talk.
Well, and where can people follow you on Twitter?
AK Stanwyck. And Screen Talk is also on iTunes as well.
I guess we should also point out you can go to thompsononhollywood.com or, you know, the problem with sending people to IndieWire is they may not actually wind their way into your blog.
Well, they can always Google, you know, search for Ann Thompson's name on IndieWire. I'm sure they'll find lots of stuff there.
Actually, the on the right rail of the front page of IndieWire, they feature content from the playlist Thompson on Hollywood and Shadow and Act more than right there on the right rail anytime you want to see what the most recent story from the blog actually is.
Wow, that sounds so insidery. The right rail.
We're undergoing some redesigns right now, so it's all the wild, wild west as usual, as everybody grows and gets more sophisticated.
Well, Anne, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and discuss Telluride, Toronto, and of course your new podcast, Screen Talk. We just told you how you can find Anne on Twitter and on the web. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. You too. It was always fun to do this. It's part of the ritual.
I'll see you in New York.
To New York.
Well, I guess I'll continue my lonely crusade against Abu Dhabi.
I know. You bring it up all the time, and everybody's like,
nobody cares.
And there's like crickets in the background.
Make their own decision. Blah, blah, blah. Whatever.
Well, I'll tell you this much.
She's not going to Abu Dhabi. What does she care?
Yeah, well, and the she in this case is Ann Thompson, and it was great to speak with her, as always.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we appreciate her time.
And you know what? I want to point out one thing. We talked a lot about some films that appeared in Cannes this past year. If you want to hear about those films, you can go to Showbiz Sandbox episode 236, and episode 237 is where Michael and I discuss those films.
And I've just started to attend the press screenings for the New York Film Festival, and I'm going to go to a few of them this year. So happily, I've used all the buzz from other festivals to say, yeah, I don't need to see this. Okay, I'll go see that. So I'm cherry picking and going to see the movies. I've gotten really good reviews elsewhere. Just started that yesterday. Got to go back tomorrow, and looking forward to it.
And looking forward to hearing which films you liked, which films you think we should all see.
That's right. And of course, I'm excited for the Edward Snowden document they just added. I think it's a pretty big deal. That's their first time they've ever added a film to their official lineup after the lineup was closed.
Well, I would agree with you. That is a big deal rather than a big whoop, because it is time for our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Netflix, because we love talking about Netflix. Now, I've always wanted to say this. Europe is braced for invasion. Even though I've always wanted to say that, of course, the remainder of that sentence is, as Netflix comes to the continent. It's already in Great Britain, not to mention about 40 other countries. Next week, it adds France, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, and Luxembourg. But it ain't easy. France is lambasting them, and them being Netflix, for claiming headquarters in Amsterdam. Of course, that's always done for tax purposes. The Orange Telecom Service.
Orange.
Orange, yes. Although in the UK, it's Orange. No, it's Orange in the UK, sorry. And Orange in France. They have yet to come to terms with Netflix and refuse to offer Netflix on their set-top boxes, which is kind of a big deal. No pun intended. On the plus side, they've been purchasing locally grown product and are financing a French spinoff of House of Cards called Marseille. It costs about $10 a month, and clearly Netflix is betting on original content, and that original content will drive people to them. In the UK, it has a show called The Crown about political machinations during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. In Mexico, they're making a comedy series about feuds between families that own soccer clubs, which about five people in the country can say they relate to. Big deal or big whoop?
No, more can relate because they all love soccer. Okay. I'd say it's a big whoop.
What?
I mean, they're already in the UK. They're in 40 countries. They're adding more. It's just, of course, they're adding more. You know, it's a big deal long term. But as far as these six extra countries, well, OK, Luxembourg, Belgium, Austria, not very big. France and Germany and Switzerland are certainly big markets. And the more you add, the better you do. So, every country has its own challenges. Every country needs its own content that will appeal to them specifically. But also you bring your library along with you. So we'll have to see where Netflix ends up. But it's what they should be doing. It makes sense. It's been their business plan for a while. So, of course, they've added more.
A couple points here that I mentioned the fact that they're not on set-top boxes, which in France is a big deal because everybody who has the internet these days has a set-top box that delivers both internet and television. And if you can't get on that set-top box, it's kind of unlikely that Apple TV or Roku or one of those other over-the-top boxes is going to make a big push. The other thing is that they have already, and they being Netflix, have already licensed House of Cards and other original content to other distributors in France and Germany and other countries, so they can't even show that on Netflix.
It depends country to country.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So it just depends on, and that's not necessarily the big draw in those countries. I mean,
that's true.
Their big flagship show, but it may not mean a lot to people in Luxembourg.
Well, if Netflix can come to Europe, then Deezer will come to America. Deezer is a European music subscription service, and it's going to try and break into the U.S.
Good luck.
Yep, they've got a lot of competition, including Spotify, Rhapsody, RDO, Beats, Xbox, Sony, and Google Play Music. So what's Deezer's pitch? They've got great audio. That's their pitch. It costs $10 a month if you pay for an entire year up front. If not, then it costs $15 a month. But that premium pricing comes with a premium sound. If you use a Sonos home audio system, you'll get a much better quality audio streaming, essentially lossless audio. If you don't have a Sonos home audio system, then you get regular old sound quality. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Yeah,
they've got about 5 million paid subscribers in Europe. Worldwide, I guess. They've got about 16 million monthly active users. Those are people who don't, 11 million of them don't pay for it and they just get ads or whatever. And then you got 5 million paid subscribers. I assume the 16 million includes this paid subscribers. I mean, why would you not include them? But, you know, they're coming to America. They've got all these other companies already here. They cost more than other people. And their only big added on feature is great audio, but it only works if you use Sonos home audio system. Well, guess what? Most people don't have a Sonos home audio system. And most people listen to streaming, I think, on their phones or in their cars. So
right.
Who cares?
Yeah.
So, you know, good luck with that.
I would tend to agree with you. Plus, the $10 and $15 price tag is they actually said, no, it's going to be $20 a month eventually, but this is an introductory price. And I thought, really? So you're going to be...
What does Spotify cost?
$10 a month for the premium.
Okay.
So, yeah, I kind of went, okay, you're supposed to differentiate yourself, and the lossless audio is a good way to go. Being more expensive, maybe not so much. According to New York Magazine and other sites, i.e. the entire internet, people are outraged over Apple's dumping of a free U2 album onto their iTunes library. Some sites quoted tweets by people who expressed anger or, jokingly maybe, wondered who this act U2 might be and why its music was all over their phone. Others discussed the technical issues involved for those who actually didn't want a U2 album in their library but had a tricky time deleting it. Apple offered a quick fix to that they actually have a special webpage you can go to. Game sites offer free things like this, but it's usually an opt-in action. Whereas with the U2 album, Apple just added it to everyone's library automatically. Hence the Big Brother blowback. That's right. Apple is learning opt-in versus opt-out. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
Don't you agree? This is a classic internet echo chamber. New York Magazine saw some tweets and said, oh, everybody's furious that they were given a free U2 album. And then you look at the tweets, and most of them are just jokes. They don't even see, who's this U2 band? I'm pretty sure that's a joke.
Yes. Now, what's interesting to me is that I spoke with a couple 14-year-olds who were very, very interested in going to see, some of whom actually went to the Rose Bowl this past weekend to see One Direction. They were very excited.
Were they 14-year-old girls?
They were 14-year-old girls. Yes, I just said 14-year-old girls. Now,
I didn't hear the girls part.
Okay. Yes, they were all 14-year-old girls who were at soccer over the weekend. And so they were all talking about going to see One Direction and 5 Seconds of Summer, I think, is the other.
Yeah, it's another boy band.
Yeah, that
Australia,
they were.
Australia, I think.
They were even more excited about that. And I said, oh, the Rose Bowl, I don't think I've seen a concert there since U2. They actually said, oh, wait a second, U2? That's a band, right? Yeah, I think something appeared on my phone about them. I think their music just downloaded onto my phone for some reason. And I said, well, they're a pretty big band. Have you ever heard of them? Two out of the four had.
Well, they're 14-year-old kids.
Right.
Well, nobody's saying that everybody in the world knows who U2 is, but those tweets that they found were, half of them were jokes. The world is not outraged that they were given a free U2 album. It's very easy to delete, for God's sakes, if for some reason you not only do not want it, but you refuse to ever look at it again. It's not that complicated. It's a complete tempest in a teapot.
Right.
It's total BS. You look at the actual things that they saw, some tweets.
Remember that SEO stuff that Ann Thompson was just talking about?
Right.
It really helps if you have U2 in your headline.
Yeah, but not... Yeah.
And that's really what this is all about. We got a couple of pieces of email. Pieces of email? No, we got a couple of emails after last week's show asking us, gee, how much money did Apple pay? Nobody knows how much money Apple paid to get the exclusive of this.
I don't know. I don't know that they did. I don't know that they paid anything.
I think they're paying based on downloads, ironically, which is why they may have been so quick to offer that deletion page.
But No, because it was automatically given to everyone. So 500 million people got it handed to them for free. So it couldn't be how many people chose to download it, because it was basically just,
right.
They wouldn't pay for 100 million downloads. I think it was just a promotional in-kind thing. U2 was like, let's just give our album away. And instead of opting in, they'd never done this before. And so technically they could have perhaps chosen a better way, but I doubt U2 and Apple wanted that. I'm sure U2 wanted to be on everybody's iPhone and their library automatically, because then people more likely listen to it. If you tell people, press this button and you'll opt in, 90% of the people won't bother to do it.
Right.
So more likely now, some people got this, sort of had it all sort of automatically on their phone, and then they actually listened to it. And that was the value to U2, getting people to listen to their music who might not have otherwise or haven't in a long time. So I imagine no money exchanged hands. I imagine U2 did it for the publicity and Apple did it for the fun, and the publicity, and everybody wins because they're going to go on tour and sell, $800 million worth of tickets.
Well, 17 albums is how many albums of U2's returned to the iTunes Store's top 100 after.
Right, another ridiculous story. 17 albums appeared on the iTunes 100. Yeah, how many units sold? Albums don't sell. Big deal that they jumped up for a minute on the charts and went to number 84. That might mean they sold 1,000 copies. So, if you told me U2 sold 2.3 million copies of their catalog in the last week, I'd be very interested. But when you tell me it went to number 84 on the iTunes chart, that is meaningless to me. And knowing how few even albums at number one sell, we're talking probably extremely modest sales. Probably didn't break 100,000 copies. But if anybody wants to correct us, I'd love to hear it.
Actually, I can correct figures. You. Because Maroon 5's album last week sold 164,000 copies, all told, not just on iTunes. So I just happen to know that. So
No. I'm saying, how many did U2 sell? I don't give a damn what Maroon 5's. I'm telling you, the number one album in the country barely sells 100,000 copies. So big deal that they had an album rank 84 on one particular chart. That is completely, just like the Joan Rivers story, which we'll get to in a minute, that's completely meaningless.
And
number 84 on iTunes charts. How many units did they sell of their catalog? Tell us that, and then we'll know whether we have a story. I will bet you dollars to donuts it probably was less than 100,000 copies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And which is less than they would have sold if they'd released their new album on opening weekend.
You know what?
So they're trying to say, oh, they had a big bump in sales from their catalog. Look how smart they are. I'm not disagreeing that it was a smart thing to do, but don't tell me that albums charted at number 84 on the iTunes chart. Tell me how many copies they sold, and then we'll know whether it's a big deal or a big whoop.
Well, you were especially annoyed last week, Michael, about one aspect of the media covering the death of Joan Rivers. And that was the silly headlines, and this kind of speaks to what you were just talking about, these headlines screaming that her book sales had skyrocketed 500% or 1,000%, or even one Hollywood Reporter headline, which excitedly was yelling, they jumped 70,000%, and then loudly they insisted, yes, that wasn't a typo, 70,000%. Of course, the truth is that if you sell five copies one week and 500 copies the next, you've just made a huge percentage jump, but aren't exactly selling truckloads of books. The actual figures have started to trickle in from Publishers Weekly. Rivers' newest book, Diary of a Mad Diva, came out in July, just weeks before Rivers died.
Talk about good timing, God bless her.
Yeah, well, if there was ever one, she was a comedian after all.
Yeah.
It sold 747 copies the week before she died and 5,009 copies the week after, a 509% increase if you care. Her newest book in paperback, 2012's I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me, sold 42 copies one week and then the next week, 475 copies. Saying that sales jumped 500% sounds exciting, but the actual figures of 5,000 copies, yeah, not so much. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, our coverage is a big deal because we, you know, punctured this stupid yelling and screaming. And hopefully in the future, when you see something like, oh, U2's album charted at number 84, that's meaningless. 500% increase in from what to what? You have to give us actual facts.
Well, you know what they say about statistics. You know what they say about statistics.
No, they don't lie. You can tell when they tell you something increased 500%, but don't tell you what, that it's probably not worth knowing. When they say U2's album's moved to number 84, who cares? Tell me how many copies they sold. You just have to know what to look for. They don't lie. You're just lazy reporting by other people.
Well, I was going to say statistics can say anything you want to make them say, but that's...
That's not if you're paying attention.
Okay. Well, actress Elizabeth Moss, you know who she is?
I do.
Yeah, she is seizing the moment. With the TV series Mad Men coming to an end next spring, she's poised to make the most of it. She has several films in the can, including the art house project Listen Up, Philip, starring Jason Schwartzman, opening in January.
Playing at the New York Film Festival. I'm going to see it in a week or two.
I saw it and liked it. I'd be interested to see what you have to say.
She good? Is she good?
I think she is good in that film, actually. Great. Yeah. Well, just as Mad Men hits its peak, she'll star on Broadway in the first revival of the hit play The Heidi Chronicles. Hey, it worked for Bryan Cranston. Why can't it work for Elizabeth Moss? Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, big whoop, you know. I mean, actress gets work. It's happening in the spring. I've never seen The Heidi Chronicles. I'm looking forward to seeing her, though. Jason Biggs, I think, is the male lead. There's an odd choice.
Ooh.
But it's also Bryce Pinkham from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, a very talented actor. So, you know, it's just a smart work on her team. That's what you should do. Your show's coming to an end. You see it coming in advance. Work on every level that you can. Do a Broadway show, do a movie. You know, it's just a smart thing to do.
Charlie Hunnam may have run screaming from the naughty movie franchise 50 Shades of Grey, but he's got two big blockbusters coming up, a sequel to Pacific Rim and that King Arthur franchise we spoke about a week or two ago, and now his TV series, Sons of Anarchy, is finishing up in style. The premiere of the final season on FX has scored 10.62 million viewers once all the numbers were added up, making it the most watched show in the channel's history. And almost 7 million of those viewers were in the 18 to 49 demographic that advertisers just love. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. You know, the show's going out in style. It's been building year after year after year. You always like to see that. And, you know, that 10 million viewers, put a pin in that because that's not, you know, the overnight numbers. Those are after 3 or 5 days have all been added up together. And that's what really matters.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. At least not on my Kindle. Yes, poetry is one of the oldest forms of literature, predating the novel, of course, but it's been a long time coming onto e-readers. The problem? You name it. People have various devices and can fiddle with the font size on any of them, making it nigh impossible to present poems in their proper way, with the appropriate line breaks and, it, you know, the appropriate visual force. Yes, poems are visual, and it matters greatly how they look on a page and where the punctuation is. Bringing that over to a screen and figuring out whether the screen is a smartphone or a giant tablet, well, that's very difficult. But with ebooks clearly ensconced in the library and literary landscape, publishers are now finally taking the time to code each individual poem for various devices, offering glorified PDFs and other tactics to make poetry available. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. I mean, because poetry has literally been invisible on ebooks. And whenever I do get a galley of a poetry book for a reading in advance, it's like a disaster. You can't read it. It's just such a jumble. The line breaks are wrong. Everything is confused. It's, you know, and poetry was, you know, already it's a very rarefied area of literature. Not a lot of people read poetry, but I love poems. And to see them like literally disappearing and literally not available as ebooks, meaning a lot of people in the future might not ever even remotely get exposed to them, even for free. That was kind of a bad thing. So I'm really glad that they're actually buckling down and saying, look, we gotta step up to the plate. There are still some poets that say, no, I don't want my poems in ebooks because it can't be presented properly. And I understand that, but you gotta do something. At least haikus. Give me haikus. You can do that one.
I'm surprised some poet hasn't tried to figure out a way to exploit the fluidity, I guess would be the proper term of the ebook screen.
Because there's not a screen. That's the problem. You could write a poem for Twitter and say, all right, it's going to be 170 characters, just like a limitation, just like a haiku. But what can you do? There's no way visually to guarantee how people will see your poem. And the visual matters. The line breaks matter incredibly much. So it's just really hard to do.
In its biggest video game play to date, Microsoft has spent $2.5 billion to buy Minecraft, the wildly successful online game and community. They have since reported that the productivity of their employees has plummeted. I'm kidding. Minecraft is a sandbox game. That is a game where people can play, you know, they play with in the environment to do unexpected things that help, you know, the environment to evolve. And it has sold more than 50 million copies worldwide. Mojang, the company behind it, has launched some modest games intended as charity fundraisers. One big project called Cobalt, now in alpha, and Scrolls, which has no release date. I don't know if they're ever going to finish Scrolls, actually. I know that
they're not sure who gets the rights to it now either. So, yeah.
Yeah. The founders of the company and the creator of Minecraft will be leaving Mojang. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
What?
As in, oh, not a great deal to make. Well, what are you buying? You're buying an already mature game and you're giving up all the people who created it and the future projects that they have in the works.
Okay,
what the heck are they buying?
A couple of points here. Notch, who is the developer, the actual...
He's leaving.
Okay, he had not been involved with Minecraft for months, if not years, and he wrote a long post.
Yeah, he didn't want the pressure, he couldn't handle it, blah, blah, blah. But all the top people are leaving. It's not just Notch.
Yeah, he was basically like, look, I never wanted this. I'm not a CEO. I just made this
game.
Just
give me my $500 million and I'll leave everybody alone.
Right. Now, I will say that, you know, I agree with you. It is a mature game. It's been out in the marketplace for 2-3 years. However, because it's kind of like Legos, you know.
People keep playing with it.
Yes, it's never done. So
right. It
might actually, if they market it right and develop it properly, might have a lot of life left in it.
I'm sure it might, but it seems like a lot of money to pay for a mature game that you could, you know, screw up if they decide it's not cool anymore.
Well, what they might be buying is a platform rather than a game.
What's the platform?
Minecraft.
What do you mean?
Meaning that it's more than just a game. It's not just a game with a set beginning, middle, and end.
Right. It's a sandbox game where you get to play with it. It's malleable and you can build on it and add it to it and evolve. Right. But if the community decides Microsoft is not a cool overseer for their community, they might just get bored and move away.
Good point.
And all the talented people that you're paying, you're not paying for any future games from what I can gather. Like, good God, at least if you had Scrolls on the books and that was coming out, Cobalt doesn't seem to have set the world on fire. And Scrolls, so this is it. You're buying a very, very mature game with a big, big community. Lots of people using it worldwide, but I don't know. To me, it seems like they're paying a premium price for a service that has no future potential in the sense of other games and other things. All the talent is gone. I'm always worried if you buy a company and the talent leaves.
I was going to actually make a joke here about how Microsoft plans on improving the graphic quality. Since basically it's the whole game is played in 8-bit graphics purposefully. Now, the big trend in movies is to release them digitally, days, if not weeks, before they come out on DVD and Blu-ray. Studios want people to buy movies in the digital format because, you know, it's cheaper for the studios and they make more money on it. Well, Annie Lennox of Eurythmics is going in the opposite direction. Her new album is a collection of standards being released on the iconic jazz label Blue Note. And Lennox is putting it out in vinyl, on vinyl, I should say, the once dusty format that has regained cult status. Yes, the only format available for her new album Nostalgia on September 30th is an LP, because that's the way the music was meant to be heard, right down to a side one devoted to socially conscious music like Strange Fruit, and a side two devoted to love songs. Kids, if you don't know what we're talking about, ask your folks what a side is.
And then ask them who U2 is.
Yes, apparently. Then, about a month later, Annie Lennox is going to put the album out on CD and via digital download. Big deal or big whoop?
Ah, it's a big whoop, of course. It's a clever stunt. It brings attention to it. I love it. It's kind of fun. And, you know, we've been seeing actual substantial album sales. I think Jack White, did he sell like 30,000 copies on LP?
Yes.
Well, you know, when you're only selling 100,000 copies in that week, that starts to be serious money. So I've always poo-pooed the idea that LP is making a comeback. And it's not making a comeback. People are not going to suddenly start listening to LPs as their primary source of music information. But, you know, this is fun. It's cool. It's a clever idea.
When does putting a brave face on bad press change from smart PR to misleading shareholders? Well, guess what? SeaWorld might find out. They've been roiled by the documentary film Blackfish, also a Sundance entry from 2 years ago, by the way, which revealed various aspects of the company and its treatment of orca whales, killer whales, that have given SeaWorld a black eye and perhaps made families less likely to attend their theme parks. In discussing lower attendance, the company has repeatedly cited anything but the film Blackfish until, well, very recently, both in comments and in SEC filings. Finally, in August, they agreed that, yes, the film and its repeated airings on CNN have had an impact, including potential legislation in California making it illegal to keep orca whales in captivity for purposes of entertainment, i.e., exactly what they do. The company's stock fell 33%, and now shareholders are suing. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's a big deal. Companies need to change how they deal with shareholders and what they say and don't say. It's always good PR to just acknowledge the elephant in the room, or the orca whale, the killer whale in the room. You know, don't ignore basic facts. You're not fooling anybody. Nobody was, you know, convinced that they were telling the truth. So why do it? Now they've gotten themselves into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when it was, quote unquote, a documentary, just a documentary, that it was harder to find and harder to see. Then when it aired on CNN, forget about it. It went, you know, everybody saw it.
Well, see, you know, repeated airings doesn't help. But again, you know, virally and all that sort of stuff, just pretending a movie that's belittling your company isn't helping, you know, just acknowledge it and move on. You know, why pretend it's not happening?
But I do know people who have avoided going to SeaWorld after seeing that documentary.
Ah, well, there you go.
So it has affected the attendance at their theme parks.
This next story came in an email a few minutes before we started the show. I saw the tag on the email and I just burst out laughing. It's the headline.
The United Nations names Leonardo DiCaprio a messenger of peace. That's right. The UN has designated actor Leonardo DiCaprio a messenger of peace. No, he won't stop all war. So, you know.
So
calm
the kid
down.
From Titanic probably could have. Today, not so much.
That's right, because he was king of the world, you see.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, specifically, DiCaprio has been named a messenger of peace on climate change and will speak on September 23rd at the Worldwide Summit to address that crisis. Other Hollywood industry notables that have been bestowed the messenger of peace title by the UN in recent years include Edward Norton, Michael Douglas, Charlize Theron, George Clooney, and Stevie Wonder. Their purpose? To gain media attention for the works of the UN that the typical functionary might not garner. And that's why I'm very upset at having been passed over
for
the role of messenger of peace. Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, though. DiCaprio has been involved in climate change and environmental issues for many years, and he's done a good job, and he's given some good smart speeches. I hope he'll do the same here. And then it does bring attention to it because it's an incredibly important issue. Are you coming to New York to walk in the climate change walk, Sperling?
You know what?
It's Sunday.
Yes, but
it's for your children's future.
It's so hot outside, I'm not setting foot out the door.
Should we connect those two?
Exactly.
My friends in Nashville said, oh, yeah, we're coming up. We've rented a Gulfstream mobile home, and it runs on coal, oddly enough, but we're looking forward to getting up there. We'll be there soon enough.
You'll be able to see us from the plume
from miles
of black,
away.
Black smoke rising from our RV.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, you know, there's a couple things going on here. Michael believes one of these stories isn't very important. I'm sure the people who are being laid off do. But let's talk.
Oh, I didn't think we were going to talk about that. Okay.
Okay. Well, then maybe That's let's talk about this first. Actually, yeah. Okay. So Time Warner and CBS, they're both. Well, no, Time Warner is laying people off, effectively. Warner Brothers is laying people off. And this comes right after 21st Century Fox and Rupert Murdoch made this, you know, $80 billion offer to buy Time Warner, which sent the stock skyrocketing. When Rupert Murdoch and his group pulled out, of course, the stock plummeted. So now Jeff Bukes, or Bukes, I always confuse how to pronounce his name. He is the CEO of Time Warner. He needs to get the stock price up because it plummeted. So one way to do that is to make more money. One way to do that is to have less overhead. So that's what's going on there. But another way to do that is to offer another product and sell more of a product that you already offer. And that would be HBO Go.
Okay, now you're really confusing me. Okay, so we've combined two stories here. First of all, Time Warner is laying people off. Well, all right, so is every other corporation in America. People don't like employees anymore. I don't think it's a Machiavellian backlash from the Rupert Murdoch bid. I think it's just something they've been doing for several years, and they're doing more of it now. I don't think there's particularly linked one way or the other. The Hollywood Reporter story said, well, they could be buying something instead of having to lay people off, but because of Jeff Bukes, they're going to have to fire people. I mean, yeah, he's in charge, so he's firing people, but I just don't see the two linked in any particular way. Do you?
Yeah, I think they need a short-term stock price boost.
And firing people always helps.
Well, you know, I never think it helps, but, you know, higher earnings cause stock prices to rise in the short term, which then leads stockholders to go, yeah, that guy knows what he's doing. The next time somebody comes along and tries to buy us, maybe we'll let him continue to do what he's doing. As opposed to, hey, yeah, the last time we were offered $80 billion and now, he turned it down and, gee, maybe we should take this next offer that comes up. I think that Time Warner was retrenching and contracting anyway.
Right. So as far as HBO and HBO To Go, there's a couple things. One other way to sort of spotlight your stock is to show how much the company should be valued at. And one way to do that is to sell off 20% of part of your company, like 20% of HBO, and make that its own stock and let that track on the market and see how well that does. And then people can say, oh, look how much your company's worth. So they're not looking to sell off HBO, but they might want to make part of it a stock that can be traded on its own and to show how highly valued it is.
So basically, that's called a spinoff when you do that.
That's right. And the other possible thing is, you know, everybody's talking about going over the top, turning their channels like Showtime and HBO and CBS and ABC and ESPN and everything else into an over-the-top service, meaning something you don't get through your cable provider. You just get it online, right?
Right.
And that's something that HBO does in countries where it doesn't have a cable channel. And it's something people seem to think that they want for North America, but it may not be that appealing once it actually arrives. But everybody's like, oh, if only I could buy HBO. Well, then what about all your other TV channels? But anyway, that's something everybody's looking into, and certainly HBO is as well. But we just saw that HBO provides like a third of all of Time Warner's profits. A third of all their profits, this huge conglomerate, come from HBO. And do they really want to mess with that? You know, the last thing they want to do is jump into, you know, over-the-top TV and hurt the ecosystem that's been supporting their cable channel and making it so hugely profitable. And it's hugely profitable because they get it from their cable provider and the cable provider wants people to get it and it's part of all their packages and, you know, it all feeds into each other. But they actually are worried about leaving money on the table and losing something. They're worried, like, what about this big ecosystem we have already in place? Let's pause before we, you know, drive a dagger into its heart and find out what we have going over the top.
Yes, I agree with that. Absolutely. They are concerned about the ecosystem that's in place, their distribution channel already in place.
And they make tons of money off of it.
Yes.
It's hugely profitable. So yes, they're thinking about it and they're like, look, it's going to happen in a few years, like
right.
3 to 5 years from now.
Yeah.
Lots of channels. But you know what? Time Warner Cable sits there. This is a separate company that is your cable provider, say Comcast or somebody like that. They're your cable provider. They see you only just wanting broadband and canceling your cable subscription because now you're getting all these channels over the top. You think they're going to be happy about losing that $110 a month that they got for your cable system and just paying you broadband? Uh-uh. They're going to try to drive up your broadband service. That's why there's all these other fights about broadband and who has to pay what for what and for whom and who has to pay and can we charge more and net neutrality. The comment period just added for net neutrality, by the way. The FCC is considering changes to their rules. They decided we should let companies charge. Just let the market do what it does. This is the Obama administration, by the way. And now everybody's commented and freaking out and said, and that comment period just ended, and we'll have to see what they come up with.
Now, just to give you some sense as to how, in the United States, how much on the radar this was, the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction moment, the FCC received 1.5 million comments on that. So
when was that?
That was in 2003, 2004, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And on this initiative, the FCC received over 3 million comments.
That's it?
Well, that's
they
actually...
They only got twice as many for this as they did for Janet Jackson, and that was 11 years ago?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, that's seen
pathetic.
I
was one of them, but I can't believe it's that low. That's pathetic.
That's actually seen as quite a lot. It's seen as a lot.
By who?
Look at all the other comment periods and all the other...
Well,
you know,
Janet Jackson got 1.5 million. You know why? Because the religious right mobilized their base. You're telling me people who care about net neutrality couldn't get more than 3 million emails sent to the FCC? You get more of that for the U2 thing.
That's true.
That's really low. I'm one of them, and I think that's pathetic.
Well, I guess
that to me is lame. That was 11 years ago when people were not as socially savvy as far as complaining and email and all that. Nowadays, it's so easy to click a button and send an email and do, you know, that's, wow, I'm a little shocked how low that is.
Well, and you know, nowadays, it's a lot easier to watch a show later, as you just pointed out, than when it airs. And Les Moonves is saying, and he's the head of CBS, is saying, hey, you know what? It's so easy that overnight ratings don't mean anything anymore.
That's right. I get an email every day from TV Media Insights. We've had the creator of that on our show sometimes. It's Mark Berman, right? That's
right.
His name. And he's a nice guy, and I love his stuff, and I love the information. And every day you'd look in your email inbox, and you'd find out what the networks were looking at, the overnight ratings for TV shows. Now I don't even want those numbers in my head because they're so not important as far as what the final figures will be. They're so misleading in a way because the final numbers will grow by 2 million, 3 million, 5 million, 8 million copies. I mean, it makes a big difference. So I don't even like to hear what the overnights are because it just gets in my head and it's a little confusing. I wish somebody would give me the Live Plus 7 ratings. I can't even get TV Weekly ratings showing, you know, it takes like weeks, months to get actual figures because it takes weeks and months for people to watch them.
Well,
but
you know, Les
overnight
Moonves,
ratings now are just, you know, now when you get your email from TV Media Insights, it literally has a disclaimer. This guy's been doing this for decades. And there's a disclaimer now at the beginning of the email that says, this is for a lot of savvy people who read this stuff all the time. And he says, all right, overnight ratings for last night. It says, all right, the following is based on household overnights. They're subject to change given the availability of other pending data streams. As always, these overnights are your first look at the ratings and a precursor to what could lie ahead. We take into account other benchmarks, including the expected demographic ratings, potential DVR usage, the critical acclaim, and the social media presence. So, like, yes, these are overnights, but we know it's going to change. So, yeah, you know, overnight ratings now, as far as media reporting, I don't know why we do it anymore.
Well, Les Moonves, the head of CBS, as I just mentioned, he pointed out that for a show like Elementary, that when it airs, it gets it gets 9 million viewers per episode, right? But they actually get paid for 14 million because 5 million people watch it, you know, I guess 3 days later. They get paid for C3, so basically the airing plus 3 days later.
You watch your show later that night, if you watch Elementary later that night or the next day, within 3 days of its airing, that gets counted as a viewer that advertisers are willing to pay for. If you watch it 2 weeks later, advertisers are like, hey, that movie I was promoting is already opened. I don't care. I'm not paying for that viewer. So they pay for Live plus 3, which is all the viewers that watch it live or within 3 days on their DVR.
Well, and right now I'm watching Modern Family, and I have to say the advertisements for Gravity make it look like a wonderful movie. Okay, because it's a year old. That said, The fact that I know that Gravity was advertised, there's a reason for that. Because as I'm fast-forwarding through the commercials and all the JCPenney commercials that were on during the holidays, I'm actually paying attention. Okay, I may not be hearing what they're trying to sell, but I kind of do because I'm paying attention. I'm watching the screen. You know, what Les Moonves wants is he wants advertisers to pay for see infinity, meaning he wants basically all the viewing whenever it happens to be counted. Well, the problem is you have to draw the line somewhere, right?
Well, he's joking, obviously.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
How can you count somebody who watches an episode 4 years later? What, on DVD? You can't pay for that.
Well, and
he's just saying every viewer matters and we need to have a much bigger net in order to show exactly how popular a show is.
Yeah, and he was talking at a Goldman Sachs conference in New York when all of this came out, and he said, and this is to a point you make on a regular basis, Michael, about the fact that there is no more season for the television world. The summer marketplace didn't exist before Netflix and Amazon came into play and provided a lot of money. It is also helped by the great growth in the international marketplace. So he's saying, hey, guess what? We premiere shows all the time now.
And by the way, the international marketplace, again, I don't think I virtually ever read a number about how much a show has sold overseas, how much money it's made overseas, how much money it's made in selling its own format into other shows overseas. If you're making a drama, or unless so a comedy in America, I'd love to hear anything you know about how well your show does overseas, because there's a lot of money there and the networks never talk about it. And that means they don't want you to know about it because they don't want you asking for a cut of the pie. It's just like DVD sales. They never would talk about them. They would absolutely was like a black hole. All they would say is number one. They wouldn't say how many copies it sold except in very rare circumstances. And that's because they didn't want everybody to realize how much money they were making.
And by everybody, you mean the people who had
all the actors and producers and writers and directors. Right. If they screwed over James Garner 40 years ago, I bet they're screwing you over today, because movies and TV shows are making a lot of money overseas. And when the networks don't talk about it, you know it must be good.
Well, you know, every time I'm in France or Germany or, in Europe, I turn on the television, it's always CSI or some show like that, usually dubbed into the native language. And I always think, does nobody make, you know,
they make tons of money off of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
That's why there's another CSI sequel coming, a spinoff, CSI New Orleans.
And that's why they keep spinning off the NFL games.
Yeah, CSI New Orleans, I think, with James Vanderbeek and Luke Perry just added to the cast as a recurring character.
Okay.
And let's talk about overnight ratings, since they're so pointless. We just got figures on The View. The View is a daytime talk show. Rosie O'Donnell, Whoopi Goldberg, Rosie Perez, who was very good. I always like her. She's fun, but she did very well. I worried she would not be clued into all the international foreign news politics, but they don't talk a lot about foreign news. She's a smart, funny woman. And also Republican political analyst Nicole Wallace was on the show.
Wilson? I don't know. Go ahead.
Nicole Wallace is on the press release.
Okay.
It's the season 18 premiere of The View. It was their highest in 8 years. The last time they had this big of a season premiere was when Rosie O'Donnell joined the cast back in 2006. It was 3.9 million people. It was the series number 2 premiere overall in total viewers.
Well, so, and that's a lot of people in the middle of the day.
And that's a show that people do want to watch as it happens. It's not a show that they want to watch on DVR the next day or 4 days later, because it's all topical and timely. So the overnights matter a little bit more. I'm sure they get a bump, but there you go. Overnights matter for certain shows like The View, and it got off to a great start.
Well, something else that got off to a great start is Thursday Night Football. CBS paid $275 million to the NFL to air 8 Thursday night football games this season, and it looks like they scored, no pun intended.
That's right. It was a big night of ratings for them. It certainly did very well. It was to be expected, but, you know, put an asterisk by that, because they led that broadcast with a lot of hard news about the Ray Rice story. They pulled Rihanna's song. That was going to be the song opening up Thursday night, just like, you know, used to be, you waiting for some football for Monday Night Football. They were going to use Rihanna's song, but they decided the conflict between that and her history of having been beaten, and then the story with Ray Rice made it a weird thing. Not only did they pull her opening performance, but they pulled the song completely, and they're not going to use it on the show at all, which I don't know if I understand that decision. That setup of not a lot of fun and trying to be hard-hitting and trying to treat, you know, this topic seriously when people just want to watch football, perhaps, they still had a really big ratings for that show. So credit to CBS for going hard news and not getting screwed over for it.
17.4 million viewers, an average 5.9 rating. Now, for those outside the country who may be wondering who Ray Rice is, he is a football player for the Baltimore Ravens who were playing that very day on Thursday, and he was a videotape of him, unfortunately, in a domestic dispute with his
Domestic dispute. He beat his wife unconscious.
Yes. And a videotape of that was kind of published by TMZ, of all places. And so he was suspended by the NFL, and that all happened leading up to Thursday's game, in which 17.4 million people watched. But that concludes Inside Baseball for this week and moves us right along to our listener email. And Michael, how do people reach us?
They email us, they Twitter us, they call us on the phone.
That's right. Dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. This week, Joe Gaze actually emailed us about something from last week's show. Michael, do you want to read it?
Sure. It says, "Hey, kids, in episode 248, there was talk about Apple displaying the movie times for Forrest Gump during the announcement of the new iPhone, and why display the times for such an old title? Well, according to the movie, Forrest is a shareholder of that fruit company, so maybe they were just making him happy? See the clip from the movie." He says, "I love the show and keep up the great work. Joe Gaze, and thanks for providing a pronunciation of your name, from Wilmington, Delaware." And he's got a link, which we include in the show notes. I had totally forgotten this. At the end of Forrest Gump, it shows him getting shares in the original Apple. And, of course, that makes him wealthy for the rest of his life. I totally forgot that happened.
Very funny. And I was going to play it. But yeah, basically he said, "I don't know. I was all set because somebody, you know, one of my friends gave me, told me to buy shares of some fruit company." And he's opening up an envelope with the Apple logo on it.
The old Apple logo,
The old Apple logo. Very funny.
I totally forgot about that, so thanks for sharing that, Joe.
Well, that's ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com or 888-567-SAND. Of course, you can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts and aggregate podcasts, wherever they're giving away for free. That's usually where you can find us. And we do appreciate when you rate, review the show in those podcast directories. It does help us out. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, they can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. I'd like to thank Ann Thompson from IndieWire and Thompson on Hollywood for being here to discuss the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's a brand new website. What is it this week, Michael?
I'mthemessengerofpeace.com.
Okay, Leonardo DiCaprio may have a thing or two to say to you about that, but if you can't find...
Bring it on, Leo.
If you can't find any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry on that website, try michaelgiltz.com or run on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.